What's going to happen now? Well, there's only one variable that matters. Who wins the next election? That's the only thing that you need to know about what the future of the Supreme Court will be. So, everybody should vote accordingly.
Before we start the forum today, I am delighted to introduce the new assistant chair of the forum program. Dr. Cristina Lopez-Gattardi grew up in Miami. She was educated at Middlebury College, where she studied political science and Spanish. And Cristina earned her PhD in international relations at the School of International Studies at the University of Miami. Her thesis examined the growth of opposition in Cuba, problems and prospects for democratization. Most recently, she was on the faculty at Emory University, where she edited the Institute for Comparative and International Studies newsletter and ran major institute programs, all experiences that prepare her for the very rich opportunities at the Miller Center. She moved to Charlottesville last summer with her daughter, Carolina, and her husband, Raul Chow, who holds a tenure-track position at the Darden Graduate School of Business Administration faculty. Cristina has already started working, helping me plan events for later this spring and for the upcoming academic year, and she will assume an increasingly visible role over the next few months. So please welcome Dr. Cristina Lopez-Gattardi. Welcome to today's forum. Our speaker today, Jeffrey Toobin, is a graduate of Harvard and Harvard Law School. Jeffrey Toobin worked for independent counsel Lawrence Walsh during the Iran-Contra affair. He then served as an assistant U.S. attorney in Brooklyn, and he joined the staff of The New Yorker and became a legal analyst on television in the early 1990s. He remains a staff writer at The New Yorker, and as everyone here knows, I'm sure, is a senior analyst for CNN. Jeffrey Toobin has covered, as a journalist and a television reporter and analyst, almost every major domestic news story of the past 15 years. And out of each one of these major domestic stories, he's brought forth a top-notch and best-selling book. The Toobin Shelf is a roadmap of our recent domestic history. In 1992, he published Opening Arguments, a young lawyer's first case, United States versus Oliver North. That was followed 5 years later by The Run of His Life, The People versus O.J. Simpson. And then in 2000, A Vast Conspiracy, the real story of the sex scandal that nearly brought down a president. And then in 2001, Too Close to Call, the 36-day battle to decide the 2000 election. His most recent book deals with the Supreme Court. And we ask, why is a book about the Supreme Court on a par with these others in terms of newsworthiness? Well, to quote someone who he quotes in the book, how quickly so few have changed so much during this most recent session of the U.S. Supreme Court. His newest book, which he will discuss today and will be sold out front after his talk, is The Nine, Inside the Secret World of the Supreme Court. Please welcome Jeffrey Toobin.
Thank you so much, George. What a treat to be here. But I have to say that it is a treat to be here, but it is not an unusual treat, because I think by this point, our family qualifies as honorary Wahoos, because we have been coming to Charlottesville for more than 10 years, because we have a beloved wing of of our family here. Doug Drysdale and Elaine Haddon Drysdale are real Charlotte. See, I'm betraying my ignorance. Charlottesvillians. I think you could do a little better than that. Anyway, we're delighted to visit. I'm here with my daughter, Ellen Toobin, and it is really, and it's It's a treat. It's a treat to be back again. So, Governor Beliles, thank you for having me. George, thank you for. I'd like to begin by acknowledging someone who I've never met in person, but I understand is here, and that's one of the distinguished members of your faculty, Henry Abraham. Where's Henry? Where? There he is. Henry. How do you do, Henry? Henry Abraham is one of the great scholars on whose shoulders I have stood in this book. Henry is his book in multiple revisions, not because it needs to be fixed, because just being updated on the Supreme Court confirmation process, and it is the definitive work, and I have drawn heavily on it over the years, and it's a pleasure to we've corresponded, we've spoken on the phone, but it's nice to see what you look like. I'm here to talk about the court and my book, and it's a treat to do that. I hadn't thought of my works as a roadmap to the last decade. It's if so, it's kind of depressing, I think. Where O.J. will figure in the history of the 20th century, I'm not sure, but he'll be there somewhere, I suspect. But the Supreme Court is really a wonderful subject for me. If I can just pause again, it is a special thrill as well to see beloved friends Ed and Ginger Barber here. They're old in the sense of long time, not old, friends of our family, and it's really a treat to see you both right in front of me. But the court is a wonderful subject for me because it is at once very well known. I think all Americans recognize that it's a very important subject, but people know very little about the justices themselves, and that's why it presented such a wonderful opportunity to write about, because people, you know, Ben Bradley used to say that all of journalism comes down to a single question that everyone asks: what's he like? And I think that's what people really want to know about the Supreme Court. What are they like? And that's what the question I tried to answer with this book. Curiously, the justices themselves are aware that they occupy this world, that they are both simultaneously public and private figures, and they sometimes even have a little fun with it. For example, for reasons that remain obscure, Stephen Breyer and David Souter are frequently mistaken for each other. Now, no one really knows why this is the case. They don't look particularly alike, but they are often mistaken for each other. And one time, not too long ago, David Souter, as he often does, was driving from Washington to his home in New Hampshire, and he stopped to get something to eat at a little restaurant in Massachusetts. And a couple came up to him, and the fellow said, "I know you. You're on the Supreme Court, right?" He said, "Yes." He says, "You're Stephen Breyer, right?" And Souter didn't want to embarrass the fellow in front of his wife, so he said, "Yes, yeah, I'm Stephen Breyer." And they chatted for a little while, and the guy said, "Well, you know, let me ask you a question, Justice Breyer. What's the best thing about being on the Supreme Court?" He thought for a minute, and he said, "I'd have to say it's the privilege of serving with David Souter." Now, how can you not love an institution where that's still possible? Best part about that story is it's actually true, you know? So that's one reason I wanted to write this book, is because, you know, to answer the question, what are they like? The other question I wanted to address is why the court now? Because the court, I think, is at a turning point, potentially, in its history. And to see why, I think you need to go back to the late 60s. Because in the late 60s, that was a time when it was the last time in the court's history the court was unified ideologically. You had seven liberals on the Supreme Court. Hard to believe, right? But there were seven liberals on the Supreme Court, and the decisions of the late Warren years really reflected that. You had New York Times against Sullivan and libel law. You had the Miranda decision in criminal law, the Miranda warnings. You had Griswold versus Connecticut, where they established the right to privacy once and for all. And of course, in case after case, you had all the great civil rights decisions where they basically including Loving versus Virginia, where they declared the marriage of Barack Obama's parents legal. They said interracial marriage was constitutionally protected. So that was the court in the late 60s. But then in the quirks of fate that happened, you had four justices resign or leave the court in quick succession by Supreme Court standards. You had Chief Justice Warren, Justice Fortas, Justice Black, and Justice Harlan. They all left in very quick succession, and President Nixon had the opportunity to name four justices to the court. It's really remarkable, the quirks of constitutional history. Jimmy Carter was president for 4 years, the only president in our history to serve an entire term without having the opportunity to name a single justice to the court. No one left while he was president. But Richard Nixon was only president for 5.5 years. You'll recall he had to leave early. That was in all the papers. And Nixon left, he got 5.5 years, he got to name four justices. And a lot of people thought, well, that's going to change the court completely. The court is now going to become a conservative institution. But the thing that I think is interesting as we look back historically, and one of the themes I tried to explore in the Nine, is the transformation of the Republican Party. Because the Republican Party of Richard Nixon was a very different institution than the Republican Party of George W. Bush. And the appointments to the Supreme Court of the presidents, the Republican presidents in particular, during that nearly 40 years, was, I think, reflects the evolution of the party. So Nixon's four appointments to the court were Chief Justice Warren Burger, William Rehnquist, Lewis Powell, and Harry Blackmun. And if you look at those four justices, you see certainly more conservative appointments than either President Johnson made or even President Eisenhower. But it is not a particularly right-wing group of justices. And if you look at the court in the 1970s, you see that this court was somewhat more conservative than the late Warren court, but actually not all that much more conservative. And in fact, many of the most celebrated decisions of the 70s were in fact liberal decisions. You had the expansion of libel protections in cases like the Gertz decision. You had U.S. v. Nixon, the case that forced Nixon himself out of office in 1974. You had a decision supporting the right of federal judges to order school busing. And of course, still the most controversial decision of all of our lifetime, I suspect, Roe versus Wade, 1973, a 7-2 decision with three of the four Nixon justices in the majority supporting a constitutional right to choose. That was written, of course, by Harry Blackmun, and the only two dissenters were William Rehnquist and Byron White, who was an appointment of President Kennedy. So, you know, that I think accurately reflected where the Republican Party was in the 70s, Nixon's appointments. And it was really only in 1980, with the election of Ronald Reagan, that you started to see a real serious national critique of liberal jurisprudence coming from the conservative movement. Edwin Meese, who became Attorney General shortly thereafter, was someone who said, look, we need to start organizing a conservative agenda for the courts, just like there has been a liberal agenda for the courts. 1981 was the year that the Federalist Society was founded. You know, a lot of liberals today talk about the Federalist Society as if it's something out of the Da Vinci Code, that it's like the secret society. There's nothing secret or sinister about the Federalist Society. It's a group of conservative lawyers that has been organizing for a long time, holding conferences, and only recently have liberals smartened up and organized a liberal counterpart. It's called the American Constitution Society. It's thriving, but it reflects that, you know, law has become a very much a political battlefield. So what was that conservative agenda that Meese and the Federalist Society started bringing forward? Well, you had expand executive power, end racial preferences intended to assist African Americans, speed up executions, welcome religion into the public sphere, and above all, reverse Roe versus Wade, and allow states to ban abortion once again. But again, the party of Ronald Reagan was not the party of George W. Bush. And I think you look at Reagan's appointments to the court and you see that it was not an entirely conservative movement. One thing conservatives did do in the early 1980s was start coming to Washington in great numbers. You had charismatic, intelligent, highly motivated, conservative young lawyers coming to Washington in particular, and two of the best and the brightest who came to Washington during that period were John Roberts and Samuel Alito. And what you saw was they were foot soldiers in the new conservative movement. In 1985, Samuel Alito, who was in the Justice Department, in the Solicitor General's office at the time, he wrote in a memo, "What can be made of this opportunity to advance the goal of bringing about the eventual overruling of Roe versus Wade?" Later that year, applying for a promotion in the Justice Department, Alito wrote, "I am particularly proud of my contributions to recent cases in which the government has argued in the Supreme Court that the Constitution does not protect the right to an abortion." These were what the conservative foot soldiers believed. But Ronald Reagan, as I said, his party was not fully conservative. And if you look at his appointments, remember, in the 1980 election, Ronald Reagan made a promise that Jimmy Carter didn't make. He said, if I'm elected president, then all the appointments of presidents only came 20 years later, but we'll get to that. If I'm elected president, I will appoint a woman to the Supreme Court. So when Potter Stewart unexpectedly resigned very early in Reagan's term, Reagan said to his deputies, look, find me a woman. Don't find me someone who's going to overrule Roe versus Wade. That's not my priority. My priority is to find a woman. And that's where they found Sandra Day O'Connor. Not an obvious choice by any means. She was not even on the highest court in Arizona. She was on the Intermediate Appeals Court in Arizona. And she had a compelling personal story. She had been a Senate, the majority leader of the Arizona State Senate. She was someone who Reagan immediately liked. And she was conservative, but certainly not an ideologue. And if you look at Reagan's appointments to the court, you definitely see that the party is moving to the right, but not as far as it would get. 1986, Chief Justice Berger steps down. Reagan elevates William Rehnquist to be Chief Justice and names Antonin Scalia to that seat, certainly very conservative. A year later, a really major turning point in the history of the court. 1987, Lewis Powell resigns. And Lewis Powell was, in a term I think we journalists probably somewhat overuse, the justices don't like it when we call him this, but he was the swing vote. He was really someone who was in the middle of the court, controlled the outcome of a lot of cases, and Ronald Reagan appointed Robert Bork to replace him. And it was really the only time in my lifetime that the country had a national conversation about the Constitution, because Bork had such a long record and distinguished record as a conservative scholar, thought the right to privacy did not exist, called the Civil Rights Act a monstrous thing. And the country, the Senate, which was in Democratic hands at the time, had just turned over in the 1986 election, said, you know what? Too conservative. It's just, he's not what we want in a Supreme Court justice, and he was voted down. And Howard Baker, who was the White House Chief of Staff at the time, said to President Reagan, look, we can't get someone that conservative through the Senate, so we've got to appoint someone else. Thus, Anthony Kennedy. And that's who that seat went to. And I think, you know, as sometimes people talk about Anthony Kennedy as being this big surprise that he wasn't all that conservative. Well, that's not true. If you look at Kennedy's record on the Ninth Circuit, if you look at why he was appointed, why he was confirmed so easily, it was clear he was conservative, but not as conservative as, say, Bork or Scalia. And that really established the court for the next few years. And that really brings us to the Rehnquist years, which is the heart of what my book is about. Just a couple of things about the Rehnquist court that you might not know. Now, one of my great inspirations writing the Nine, as well as Professor Abraham's book, is The Brethren. A book by Bob Woodward and Scott Armstrong. It was published in 1979, the first really juicy behind-the-scenes book about the Supreme Court. And one of the themes of that book was how the justices all despised Warren Burger. And they thought he was a pompous jerk, and it was really juicy stuff. And that actually, there's been a lot of that in the history of Supreme Court, a lot of very contentious relationships among the justices. I'm sure not all of you have had the misfortune to know of a justice on the court named James McReynolds, who served on the court. See, Professor Abraham's laughing because he knows what I'm going to say. Justice McReynolds was such a horrible anti-Semite that when Cardoza or Brandeis would speak in conference, he'd get up and leave. Just a repulsive human being. William O. Douglas, the fiery liberal, an extremely unpleasant and difficult person, used to spend his summers in rural Washington State, and one time had a terrible accident and drove his car off a cliff. And the first question everyone asked back at the court was, where was Felix Frankfurter at the time? Because they thought he drove him right off. That's how much they hated each other. And so as I started on the Nine, I thought, wow, this is great. I'm going to have the same kind of stories about the Rehnquist court. Alas, it was not so. Because William Rehnquist really learned from Warren Burger's example. And he was a very popular Chief Justice across the ideological spectrum. He was someone they all respected, they all liked, he treated them all fairly. And that was my misfortune as a journalist, but to our good fortune as citizens. One reason he was so popular was that he engineered a tremendous reduction in the court's workload. In the 80s, the justices were deciding about 150 cases a year. By the time Rehnquist died, they were deciding 70 or 80 cases a year. The justices, like all the rest of us, prefer less work to more work. You take 80 cases divided by 9 justices, divided by 4 law clerks apiece, it's a pretty cushy deal. It's a pretty good job being on the Supreme Court. One of the first things all lower court justices, all judges all say is, boy, I wish I could control how many cases a year I took. And during the 80s, the workload was so big that there was at one point a proposal to add a super appeals court between the 12 courts of appeals and the U.S. Supreme Court. And Warren Burger was actually a fan of this. And like all sort of judicial proposals, it went to the White House counsel's office for review. And there in the mid-80s, it went to a young lawyer named John Roberts. And John Roberts had to evaluate this proposal. And this is from the memo he wrote to his boss, the White House counsel named Fred Fielding, who is the White House counsel again today, weirdly enough. And so this is what Roberts wrote. While some of the tales of woe emanating from the court are enough to bring tears to the eyes, it is true that only Supreme Court justices and school children are expected to and do take the entire summer off. I haven't heard Chief Justice Roberts talking this way much recently. He seems to like that summer off, and as they all do. And one thing that I think remains consistent on the court through the Rehnquist years and now into the two Roberts years is the court gets along well. And you can see it if you go to the court's oral arguments. Now, the best known fact about the Supreme Court now, I would say, is that there are 8 justices who are highly engaged and ask a lot of hard questions during oral arguments, and Clarence Thomas never speaks. Now, even by Thomas's extraordinary standards, last year was extraordinary, because last year, the term that began in October 2006, there were 104 oral arguments at the Supreme Court. And Clarence Thomas did not ask a single question through the entire year. And that streak has continued so far in this term. An enterprising reporter from the McClatchy newspapers added up all the words spoken by all the justices in the course of oral arguments last term. And Stephen Breyer was first with more than 35,000 words. And Clarence Thomas was last with zero. But the thing that is worth seeing, that is worth noting, if you actually go to the oral arguments, is you see that Thomas, while never asking any questions, is not isolated, is not shunned by his colleagues. He sat for many years between Breyer and Kennedy. They pass notes. They laugh. They tell little jokes to each other. They really get along with each other, and you can see it. You can see that when you go to the oral arguments. It's useful, I think, to think of the Rehnquist Court in two parts, 1986 to 2000 and 2000 to 2005. And the dividing line in the history of the court, and in many respects the dividing line in the history of our country, is Bush v. Gore. I'm kind of obsessed with Bush v. Gore. I will admit that. I wrote my last book was Too Close to Call about the recount in Florida. I wrote about Bush v. Gore there. And one of the things I really tried hard to do in the research for that book was to interview Al Gore. And he just absolutely refused. I worked every connection I had. I tried to, I said, please get him to talk to me again. He just wouldn't do it. By coincidence, while I was working on the Nine, I happened to meet Vice President Gore. And he had read Too Close to Call, and so we were talking about that. And I told him, I said, Vice President Gore, you'll never imagine, I'm actually going back to Bush. I'm writing another book where I deal with Bush v. Gore. And I think I'm the biggest Bush v. Gore junkie in the world. And he looked at me and said, you may be second. I actually think he has a point there, because his stake in it was a little higher than mine. There are three chapters in the Nine about Bush v. Gore. I won't go into belabor that case too much, except to say that the decision and the result of it had a somewhat unexpected result. Justice O'Connor, who was in many respects the protagonist of the Nine, someone I regard as a fascinating person, someone who I think I write in the book is the most important woman in American history as a historical figure, and Bush v. Gore had a very big impact on her. Because she, of course, cast the deciding vote, as she did so often in her tenure on the court, for President Bush. And she thought that George W. Bush would be a president like his father, her kind of Republican. She thought George Herbert Walker Bush was great. And this, I think, goes back to the theme I was talking about of the change in the Republican Party, because O'Connor thought George W. Bush would be her kind of Republican, a country club Republican, a Goldwater Republican, a libertarian Republican. That's her kind of Republican. But that, I think it is safe to say, is not how the presidency of George W. Bush turned out to be, because he turned out to be a considerably more conservative figure than O'Connor, or I think most people, expected. And the story of the court from 2000 to 2005 is really the story of O'Connor's alienation from President Bush's agenda. And you see her voting with the liberals over and over again. What changed? I mean, think about the decisions from 2000 to 2005. They struck down the death penalty for the mentally retarded, struck down the death penalty for juvenile offenders. They decided Lawrence v. Texas, the case that overruled Bowers v. Hardwick and said that gay people could not be criminals because of their private sexual activity, an enormously important decision. They saved affirmative action in Justice O'Connor's decision in the University of Michigan Law School case. And in case after case, they rejected the Bush administration's position on Guantanamo and the treatment of the detainees and in the war on terror. And in all of these cases, Justice O'Connor was with the majority. Why? Well, I think there were several reasons. She was alienated by John Ashcroft. This was precisely not her kind of Republican. She was alienated by the way the war on terror was being conducted. She was alienated by the war in Iraq. And above all, she was alienated by an issue that I think, as we look back on the first decade of this century, will loom large in the history of our country, and that's the Terri Schiavo case. The Terri Schiavo case had a big impact on Justice O'Connor, in part because, if you recall what happened, it was basically an attempt by the Republican majority in the House, with President Bush's support, to tell a federal judge in Florida how to handle this case. It was a threat, O'Connor thought, to judicial independence, a cause very dear to her heart. But even more so, the Terri Schiavo case was about the government making a private medical decision for a desperately ill family member. And at the moment, the Terri Schiavo case was the big story in the United States. Justice O'Connor was dealing with the Alzheimer's disease of her husband. And her husband was slipping throughout this period into the grip of Alzheimer's disease. So this was not some abstract issue for Justice O'Connor. This was personal. And in 2003, Justice O'Connor started bringing John O'Connor to court with her every day because he had to. She wanted to keep an eye on him. And he spent the mornings in her chambers. But then in 2004, he started to do what Alzheimer's patients, alas, do so often, which was wander away. And it became very dangerous that he would just leave and wander, and sometimes they couldn't find him. And by 2005, Justice O'Connor went to her friend of 50 years, William Rehnquist, and said, look, you know, I can't handle this anymore. I have to leave the court to take care of John. Parenthetically, we may ask, how many male Supreme Court justices in history would have made that sort of choice? I don't know, but I don't think too many. But in any case, that was the choice that Justice O'Connor made. And in June of 2005, made her, at the time, surprising decision to step down. Here is where the chronology becomes interesting, I think, and important. She stepped down in June of 2005, or announced her intention to do so upon the confirmation of her successor. President Bush named John Roberts to replace her. The summer went forward with confirmation hearings being planned. Then, right on the eve of confirmation hearings, over Labor Day weekend, William Rehnquist died. Bush named Roberts to replace Rehnquist. O'Connor had to wait. Hearings went forward. Roberts was confirmed. President Bush named Harriet Myers to replace O'Connor. That tragicomedy took about a month to resolve itself. Then Samuel Alito was named. Hearings were held, and he was confirmed. All in all, it was almost a year between her announced departure and her actual departure of the court, from the court. Alas, during that year, that was when John O'Connor slipped completely into the grip of Alzheimer's disease, and he didn't even recognize his wife by the time she left the court. So simultaneously, Justice O'Connor lost her beloved seat on the court and lost her beloved husband, really remarkable and tragic story. And now there are two new justices on the court, and the court is a very different place, because the two justices who were named were very much reflect the contemporary Republican Party. They reflect a very much more conservative party than either the Reagan Republican Party or certainly the Nixon Republican Party. And we saw last term the effect on the court. We saw, you know, the abortion decision essentially reversing a decision from 2000 where they upheld the federal anti-abortion law. We saw a decision that effectively will make it much harder to challenge church church-state decisions. We saw an antitrust decision that had been considered settled law for 100 years overturned. We saw the Firestone employment discrimination case, where they made it much harder to sue for employment discrimination. And then, on the last day of the term, we saw the decision where the court overturned the desegregation attempts by the Seattle and Louisville school districts, and in a decision by Chief Justice Roberts, aimed a dagger, I think, at Justice O'Connor's opinion in the University of Michigan affirmative action case, and basically announced that they are on their way to outlawing all affirmative action. And that was the day that Stephen Breyer said the line that George quoted in his introduction. He said, "It is not often in law that so few have quickly undone so much." An unusually direct reference by one Supreme Court justice to his two new colleagues and what they were doing. And so, if I may conclude by anticipating a question, what now? What's going to happen now? Well, there's only one variable that matters. Who wins the next election? That's the only thing that you need to know about what the future of the Supreme Court will be. Because if John McCain wins, we're going to have one kind of Supreme Court. If Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton wins, we're going to have another kind of Supreme Court. And just to crystallize the issue a little more, as you know, the court now has four very conservative members: Roberts, Alito, Scalia, and Thomas. Four pretty liberal members: Stevens, Ginsburg, Souter, and Breyer, and Justice Kennedy, very much in the middle of the court, usually but not always siding with the conservatives. But three of the four liberals are going to leave, probably in the next 4 years, but almost certainly in the next 8 years. Tomorrow is John Paul Stevens' 88th birthday. Now, I hasten to add, his older brother, William Stevens, is still practicing law in Florida at the age of 91. But, you know, 88 is still 88. Justice Ginsburg is 74. Justice Souter is 69 and doesn't like the job particularly. They're not going to be around in 8 years, that is for sure. So, everybody should vote accordingly. And with that, I welcome your questions.
So, Christina Lopez-Gattardi is in the back of the room with a microphone, and I would invite those who have questions to queue up back there with Christina, and we'll take as many as we have time to take. I'd like to recognize the members of the governing board of the Virginia Bar Association who are here today as our special guests, but I hope that they won't be the only people who ask questions of Jeff Toobin. While people are getting lined up, Jeff, permit me to start with an opening question. You made reference to the very unusual term of court last year. There were, I think, 24 or 26 cases decided by a 5-4 vote. And as you pointed out, on June 28th, there were 8 straight overrules of earlier precedent. Judges on the Supreme Court don't frequently overrule, or haven't historically frequently overruled, precedent in the absence of really compelling changes in circumstances. What are the other targets that you think the Bush administration is going to tee up for this court to examine?
Well, I think, depending on your perspective, this may be good news or bad news, but the Bush administration is just about out the door. Their opportunities to tee up issues are fast waning, but you know I think the one if I might quote myself in the book, at the Supreme Court there are two kinds of cases. There are abortion cases and there are every other kind of case. I think Roe v. Wade is the transcendent legal decision, legal controversy of our lifetime, not entirely because of its particular significance, because, as is often pointed out, if Roe v. Wade were overturned tomorrow, abortion would remain legal. In all that would say is states have the right to ban abortion. Many states, to use a shorthand, the blue states, there would be no change. There'd be no change in New York and California. Abortion would immediately become illegal in many of the states of the old Confederacy. And I think in a lot of states, like Atlanta, like Georgia, like Missouri, and I suspect like Virginia, you would have brutal fights about it in the state legislature. So, you know, overturning Roe v. Wade would not immediately outlaw abortion across the country, but Roe v. Wade has taken on an enormous symbolic importance. It is also the building block for decisions like Lawrence v. Texas, where, you know, the court said there are certain areas that are off limits to government regulation, that the right to privacy is a significant one. So I think Roe v. Wade is above all, and I don't have a doubt in the world that if John McCain is elected president, Roe v. Wade is going to be overturned. And you know what? Maybe it should be. Because if Republican presidents keep getting elected on a platform of overturning Roe v. Wade, I mean, that's sort of how our system is designed to work. But I think that's a big one. I think church-state issues are a big priority. I think there's the idea that Ten Commandments should be banned, religious institutions can't receive government money. I think those kind of issues are very important. And I think one of the interesting cleavages in the Republican Party is over affirmative action. And I think this reflects a larger problem in the Republican coalition at the moment. Because if you looked at the University of Michigan case, what you saw was the old Republican establishment, the Fortune 500, the military, filing briefs saying, we want affirmative action. We view affirmative action as a competitive advantage. We cannot sell goods around the world with, you know, an all-white workforce. And Gerald Ford, this is a story I tell in the book, Gerald Ford initiated an attempt by the military, retired military, ultimately included General Schwarzkopf, General Shakazvili, a lot of famous former Joint Chiefs members, saying, we cannot have Annapolis and West Point all white. We cannot have submarines where all the officers are white and all the enlisted people are black. This is something we need for our national security. That had a big impact on Justice O'Connor. But, you know, that's not it won't have an impact on Roberts or Alito. So anyway, I apologize for such a long-winded answer, but those are areas that I think are significant. Yes.
I almost forgot my question.
I know. Sorry. It's a fair point.
You noted the unusual silence of Justice Thomas during oral arguments. Do you have any sense of how active he is behind the scenes when the justices are conferring?
None of them are particularly active in their conferring with each other. One of Rehnquist's big changes on the court was he streamlined the conference. He thought that the discussion among the justices was basically a big waste of time, because he thought we have 9 strong-willed, intelligent people. We've all thought about the Due Process Clause. We've all thought about equal protection. We're not going to convince each other much. So their conferences are very much more abbreviated than they used to be. One reason why oral argument became so much more animated on the part of the justices during the Rehnquist years is that was their only time to talk to each other. They would use oral argument to make their arguments through the vehicle of asking questions. I think Thomas, for a variety of peculiar reasons, chooses not to participate. I think mostly out of pure cussedness, that he knows people like me and, you know, the liberal media, which he really despises, point out
that he never asks questions. And he'll be damned of giving us the satisfaction of saying, see, he's changed, he's embarrassed. No, he's not. I mean, this is his thing, and I think it's going to remain that way. Yes?
I'm going to feed your obsession. I'm going to go to Bush v. Gore. You say in the book that that Justice Souter almost quit the bench as a result of that decision. But yet you also say that the justices get along. Did that decision affect the relationships among the justices on the court? Because obviously it was as divided on the court as it was in the United States.
You know, that was as close as any decision came to creating a personal rupture on the court. And one thing I heard from several justices was that it was very fortunate that for the court that Bush v. Gore was a decision in December, not in June. Because it was in December, in the middle of the court's term, it forced the justices the next week or right after Christmas to go back to work together again. And they simply had to start getting along again. Had it been at the end of the term where they could have stewed all summer at each other, it might have had a more difficult, more poisonous impact. You know, Rehnquist, much to his credit, set a tone where it said, as much as we disagree on these issues, we have to get along. And they really took that seriously. You know, the decision was December 12th, 2000. And 3 weeks later, Justice Scalia and Justice Ginsburg, as they have done for many, many years, celebrated New Year's Eve with their families together. And, you know, I wasn't there, so I can't say there weren't some gritted teeth on the part of, but you know, it did have an impact on Justice Souter, but he is a very private person, and that's not something he would have taken out on his colleagues. Professor Abraham.
Mr. Toobin, I'm not going to ask a question. Let me, as a matter of personal privilege, simply thank you for your very generous words about me. They are effusive, but they sounded rather nice. And, of course, I'm an antique now. I understand that not all antiques are bad, but I'm almost as old as Justice Stevens, whom I saw recently and who is delightful, of course. They are, incidentally, as you know, wonderful people, and you bring them to life, and that's one of the major contributions you've made. That's especially true of Justice, your analysis of Justice O'Connor. And in many ways, your insight into the individuals who mount the court is quite sui generis. That doesn't mean I agree with everything you say. That
you wouldn't be a professor otherwise.
No, as an
otherwise,
academician, yeah. I'm also jealous of you because you, I think, are going to do very well with that book, which very few academics can say. Our income, Jeffrey Toobin, is mostly psychic, I think. And it's been good. It's been good for me for 60 years. I might just point out, I disagree with some things you've said. That's natural, of course. They're mostly characterizations. For example, you disapprove of the decision in the last term of court in the Louisville and Seattle affirmative action cases. I think they were correctly decided, which means nothing. But what the Chief Justice said at the conclusion of the case, the way not to discriminate is to stop discriminating. And his stare decisis, his precedential reference, was Brown versus the Board of Education, which outlaws, as you know, discrimination on the basis of race. Well, Louisville and Seattle discriminated against whites. Brown discriminated against blacks. And Roberts' statement, I think, struck home with a lot of us. One other one other case, you didn't speak about it very much, but it is, of course, one of the great controversies of our time, is Bush v. Gore. Bush v. Gore, in my judgment, was correctly decided not because of the personalities involved, not because of the inevitable characterizations of politics involved, but because the Florida Supreme Court violated the Constitution, Article 2, Section 1, Clause 1, and also violated the Federal Code. So it seems to me the court fastened the future dissenters were not sure of their position, and Justice Ginsburg issued a per curiam opinion joined by all the other justices initially telling the Florida Supreme Court, what the hell are you talking about? Would you please tell us what you're saying and what you mean? So there are always two sides to it. One word on Justice McReynolds. He was a louse. He was not, unfortunately, a graduate of this university.
Oh, was he? Oh, I'm sorry. I did not know that.
His papers reside in the law school, if you wish to look at them.
Oh, yeah.
But he was a miserable creature, and I want to add just one other thing. He did what you said, of course. He was awful, just awful. When the Chief Justice Taft at the time wanted to take the annual photograph, he got a note from Mr. McReynolds. As you should know, when Hebrews are aboard, I'm not going to be aboard, and so the photograph could not be taken. To be a clerk for Justice McReynolds, you could not be one of the following. You couldn't be black, you couldn't be Jewish, you couldn't be Catholic, you couldn't be married, you could not smoke, you could not drink. I'm leaving something out, perhaps he had no knowledge of that. But in any event, they are of course extremely interesting people, and on the whole, and I should stop talking, I think that James Madison's wish that the bench be happily filled has become true. I would give the whole 110 a B+, maybe an A-. We've had some wonderful giants, and you bring them to life beautifully, and I thank you for doing so. And thank you again for your words. One P.S., one reason why I'm talking, I have to leave. I've been invited to a very strict hostess for dinner. Not only does she call her dinners at 6 o'clock, which are hospital hours, of which I know a great deal, I'm in a retirement home, but when I asked her for a little extra time, she graciously gave me 15 minutes.
Wow.
So, but I certainly wasn't going to run out.
Well,
so
thank you, Professor Abraham. The only response I will make is that both you and Justice Stevens are excellent advertisements for one's 80s. So what do we got next?
I had a question relating to the role of political ideologies and philosophies of jurisprudence. You trace the history of the court in recent years as kind of the history of political maneuvering in terms of the appointment of justices and the way it's almost taken on kind of a tone of a litmus test with regards to one particular decision, that which you've discussed, Roe v. Wade. Obviously, this sort of calculation is here to stay in terms of the exploration of justices' personal philosophies. Do you see any way to save the court as an impartial arbiter in the face of this new and powerful, not new, but increasingly powerful role of personal judicial philosophies?
No, I see no way of saving it. But I would disagree a little with the note of despair in your question, in the sense that when you look at the issues that are before the court, to cite two of them, does the Constitution protect a woman's right to choose abortion? May a university consider race in admissions? I don't believe that those questions have right and wrong answers. I don't believe that the Constitution compels one answer or another. I think that they are inevitably as much political as legal questions. Or to put it another way, look at Justice Ginsburg and look at Justice Scalia. Both really intelligent, both honorable, skilled. What's the difference between them? Ideology, judicial philosophy. There is no reason to pretend that we can find a judicial philosophy that is somehow outside politics. I think, if anything, the confirmation process should be more political, should be more open. I don't buy. One of the problems I have with the confirmation process is, all 18 senators on the Judiciary Committee are required by their constituents to say whether they think Roe v. Wade was correctly decided, and they vote accordingly. They get a Supreme Court nominee in front of them who undoubtedly has thought about that question, and he is allowed to say, well, it may come before the court, so I'm not going to give an answer. Why not? You have an opinion. It exists in your head, but we're supposed to guess at what it is. See, I think the answer is more candor, not less. And I just don't think that there is a way of doing this in a non-political process because these issues are so inherently political. Yes.
Hi, Mr. Tubin. I appreciate you writing such a readable book. I enjoyed it last week. My question is regarding that delicate, perhaps a fragile period right after Justice Thomas was confirmed and before he were actually sworn in. I think that you touch upon this in your book. And you talk about that, I think it was probably Washington Post
yeah.
who had that story. And the day he was, sworn in quickly, quicker than expected, they had that story that could have potentially killed his nomination, candidacy,
Right.
As a journalist, my question is, what do you think about that decision?
Well, just to thank you for reading the book, because this refers to the gentleman is asking about is, as you all remember, Clarence Thomas was confirmed after a very contentious hearing where Anita Hill claimed that he had treated her in an inappropriate way. Because the situation was so volatile and the George Herbert Walker Bush administration knew that journalists were investigating him as the last minute, during that period, after he was confirmed 52-48, but before he was sworn in, they basically rushed in the swearing in because they thought, I think correctly, that it's a lot easier, it's a lot harder to impeach a Supreme Court justice than to somehow vote him down in the initial case. The Washington Post was doing some investigative reporting about his familiarity with pornography and whatnot, and they basically dropped it after he was voted in. You know, whether that would have made any difference, I don't know. I mean, frankly, I doubt it. I think the Senate found the experience very distasteful and unpleasant and wanted to get it behind it. So I don't think, but I mean, what's interesting to me is the way he was sort of rushed through the process because they were so worried about it. Yes.
I'm interested in the point that you've made several times about the age of the Supreme Court justices. And do you think that will impact their future decisions on taking cases if it's something that has to do with cloning or new forms of communication? And would their age impact their decision-making process on taking a case?
That's an interesting question. I don't think so. I think the job keeps them pretty current with big legal developments. What I thought you were going to say is, you know, what about mandatory retirement? What about term limits? And seriously, I think that is an issue you are going to start to hear more and more about. Because in the late 18th century, when the Constitution was written, the unwritten but clear expectation of the framers was that justices would be appointed in their 40s and 50s and die relatively shortly thereafter, because everybody died relatively shortly thereafter. I mean, it was a time when lifespans were much shorter. Now, because the court is so contentious, presidents view Supreme Court justices as an opportunity to make an impact for 30 years. And 30-year terms are going to become the norm. We have seen the last 60-year-old appointed to the court. There will never be in any of our lifetime a 60-year-old appointed to the court anymore because presidents want 50-year-olds and even younger. That's what they want. And because of that, I think you are going to see serious people starting to talk about term limits and mandatory retirement because, you know, there are reasons why you shouldn't be in a job for 30 years. Stephen Breyer says something interesting about that. He gets asked about this. What do you think about mandatory retirement? And he says, well, you know, I don't have a particular problem with it, but you have to keep one thing in mind, that the Supreme Court has to be your last job. You can't be a Supreme Court justice angling for something else, which I think is an interesting point and it hadn't occurred to me. Yes.
Thank you very much for your book and your interesting presentation. You made a comment a few moments ago that many of these issues that the court faces can't find a direct answer in the Constitution. It says nothing about a right to privacy, even going back to Griswold versus Connecticut, which started the track that Roe versus Wade is on now. And the court has to look to something like the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment to find that right. How do you feel justices should resolve those questions? What should be the guiding principle if you have something that is not specifically provided in the Constitution, but it's an important issue? How do you go about finding the right answer?
Well, this is the great question about constitutional law, because the Constitution is a relatively brief document, and it is not self-executing. It doesn't give all of its answers. And I think there are a variety of factors. First you look at the text of the Constitution, then you look at the way the courts have interpreted that question. I do not think that the original intent of the framers is a meaningful or useful guide to resolving controversies. But the fact that the Constitution itself doesn't answer a question, I don't think tells you that much at all. The Constitution does not necessarily say you couldn't segregate schools. That, you know, if you offer schools to black children and schools to white children, the Constitution doesn't, on its own terms, say that's wrong. I think Brown v. Board of Education is clearly correct.
A bit closer.
Sorry?
It comes a bit closer.
But it is true. I think your question is a really hard one, and it's what all the justices struggle with. Yes.
Thank you for being here, and thank you for your astute commentaries on CNN, on the courts, as well as on politics. I turn to you and Donna Brazile and David Gergen every night of the caucuses and the primaries to see what you'll have to say, and appreciate that
so much.
You
might even say we're the best political team on television.
You might say that.
It's just,
to coin a phrase.
Just popped into my head.
Amazing. This is a quick question. Can you give us your thoughts on the pros and cons of televising oral argument and your thoughts on Senator Spector's introduced bill to require the court to televise its oral argument?
Well, I unfortunately, that has to be the last question. And I think it is preposterous that the Supreme Court is not televised, because there are some good arguments against cameras in the courtroom in trials. You know, it could intimidate witnesses. It could affect juries. There are no witnesses in the Supreme Court. All those justices have life tenure. They're not going anywhere. The stakes are enormously important, but they don't want to. They don't want to be. They like being walking through airports unmolested. You know, it's David Souter famously said the cameras will come into the Supreme Court over his dead body. So I think the prospects are remote. I think Senator Spector's bill is a great idea. I think there's an interesting separation of powers question about whether it's constitutional for Congress to pass a law saying that the Supreme Court. I don't think that bill is going anywhere. I do think that there is a little bit of change in the wind at the court. In recent years, the court has released audio of highly controversial cases the same day. They did it with Bush v. Gore. They did it with the Michigan affirmative action case. I'd be willing to bet in 10 years they'll be streaming oral arguments over the web. I think audio will be a lot easier for the court to absorb than video. I think video is going to be a very, very long time coming, and I ain't holding my breath.
Let me ask you all to please remain in place and let Jeff Toobin leave the room so he can get out to the station where he's going to be signing books for those of you who either have one or would like to acquire one. Please join me in thanking Jeff not only for his talk today, but also for his very important body of work. Thank you.
Thanks.